You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today.
And I think that it was a tremendous accomplishment, and it sort of signals a new era in science and exploration.
Ian Durham reveals the physics stories of 2014 that made it to the top of his countdown.
One of the things that we get lost in is we've made so much progress in science in the last century or more. We forget that there are some very fundamental basic problems that or questions that have never been answered.
And we give you tips for this year's FQXI contest, Trick or Truth.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
So here we are at the final Foundational Questions Institute podcast of the year. In December, we count down the biggest news stories of the year with FQXI member Ian Durham, a physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire.
This year, Ian's picked out the five best stories in foundational physics, and if you haven't done so already, then you can check out the first two parts of his rundown, which are available on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Over the past couple of years, Ian's established a reputation as a list-making maverick with his unconventional choices. So how does this year compare? Well, it's time to find out, as Ian, who spoke with Zia earlier, unveils the physics news that came in second place.
So we have a tie for number two, and the tie is between, and I'm going to mispronounce it, I know, but the Philae lander from the Rosetta mission and the Indian Mars orbiter. I'm sure everybody has heard of both of those. The Philae lander was an amazing engineering accomplishment. They landed something on an object that was tiny. And when you stop and think about the vastness of space and the size of the object they were landing on, the fact that it has virtually no gravitational pull, the fact that they were able to land on this thing, now they did need these little grappling hooks to do it, but the fact that they were able to do that is just incredible. And so Philae had to be, and in fact, it was named number one by a lot of other groups. I know the IOP's physics world named it the number one breakthrough of the year. You know, landing on a comet, that's incredible. They landed on a comet. But I think the reason it's not number one is simply because I think it is more of an engineering achievement than a physics achievement. It's still incredible and is just an absolutely amazing thing to accomplish. The comet, 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, is moving at a speed of about 55,000 kilometers per hour. And again, it's tiny. And they landed something on this, which was launched, by the way, in 2004. This has been a 10-year mission. The engineering is just incredible. So that's why I included it. Now, why did I toss the Indian Mars orbiter in there? Because I think one of the things that was amazing about the Indian mission is that the Indians did this for a really amazingly cheap price.
So there was a nice joke by the Indian Prime Minister saying that this Mars mission cost less than the making of the Hollywood film Gravity.
Yes. We have a tendency, especially the United States and to some extent the European Space Agency and others, have a tendency to do things on a very large, grand scale. What's a couple of more buttons and things? Why not just add them? Well, the Indians didn't have that kind of a budget, and yet they were able to develop an orbiter that went to Mars and successfully made it to Mars and returned data. They, in fact, are the first country to have made it to Mars on their first try. No one else has done that. The United States, the Russians / Soviet Union, and the ESA have all been to Mars, but none of them made it on their first try. The Indians are the first ones to make it on the first try, and they did it on a shoestring budget. What they said was they did it for a price that was the equivalent of a bus ticket for every citizen of India, a little less than $1 billion. Really cheap in how these things go, as far as how these things go, incredibly cheap. And I think that it was a tremendous accomplishment, and it sort of signals a new era in science and exploration, in that this is no longer just the domain of places like the United States and Russia and China, you know, the countries that have all huge amounts of money. It's now the domain of other countries as well.
You've talked about how cheap this was and how this is sort of, you know, opening the door to a new type of space exploration. But even sort of thinking about the Philae lander, the Rosetta mission, and that coming from the European Space Agency. And we also talked about the movie Interstellar, which was very much about, you know, humanity having lost interest in exploring space. And by humanity, often with these Hollywood films, they mean Americans.
Yes.
You're an American. What do you think of that when you're seeing, you know, success not only by Europe, but by other countries that you perhaps wouldn't expect?
I mean, well, that's a tricky question. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's fantastic. I think it is absolutely fantastic that other countries are doing this. I am sad that there is not as much interest in this kind of thing in the United States as there used to be. I think there's enough room for everybody in that sense. I think I wish that the United States would still be doing it, but the Indians would be doing it as well. I should point out that as you raise that point, the ESA lander on... So the Rosetta mission that I mentioned in this context, which was launched in 2004, the United States had a similar mission planned in 2001 that got axed by budget cuts. And of course, we all know, well, anyone who follows physics knows that way back, the U.S. was going to build the superglider out in Texas, where they actually had started to dig the trenches for it. I mean, they had started construction on this thing, and Congress killed the project. And this would have put us ahead of the Europeans, you know, ahead of the Large Hadron Collider in the search for a lot of fundamental physics. And, you know, I feel like there's been a waning of our sense of exploration and our sense of wonder in this country. And it bothers me because we seem to be more interested in making a buck than we are in actually discovering more about the world around us. It is what it is. But I give kudos to the Indians for doing it. I think it's fantastic.
Let me ask you about the point you made about these being engineering achievements rather than physics achievements. They certainly are incredible engineering achievements. But in terms of the physics, you know, they're going out there with goals to find out about, you know, for instance, what materials are on this comet or what's in Mars's atmosphere, sort of things like that. Do you feel that they're not very interesting results that are going to come back, or?
Well, no, I'm sure the results that will come back will be very interesting. And I think we run into a problem often where we think that, oh, just because a scientific discovery is not paradigm shift, that it's not interesting. Now, I mean, you know, none of my discoveries ever make my list. Science moves in fits and starts, and I think that the reason that I say it's primarily an engineering discovery is because, again, the criteria for my list are these big paradigm shifts, these things that are really different, where we learn something new about the universe, perhaps that we didn't expect to learn. And in this case, I mean, we might, but again, we haven't yet. That's the other thing, is this is 2014, and maybe the data hasn't come back from all of these missions yet. I think there could be major, major breakthroughs from that. We just haven't had them yet because they haven't had a chance to look through all the data. And it was such an incredible engineering achievement that it almost, not quite, but almost outshines the science in it, because it was just mind-boggling how they managed to do that. I mean, it's probably the best demonstration of astrodynamics ever.
So there you have it. India's Mars mission ties for second with the Philae comet landing, which many might have guessed would take the top spot. More info about both space exploration projects are on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. But what about first place?
For that, Brendan, you'll have to wait just a little bit longer. But I promise you, it will be revealed by the end of this edition, and it is worth the wait. In the meantime, see if you can work out what's left. But first, it's time to introduce FQXI's latest essay contest, Trick or Truth, the mysterious connection between physics and mathematics. So, Brendan, tell us more about this mystery.
Trick or truth, the mysterious connection between physics and mathematics. Well, in so many ways, physics has developed hand in hand with mathematics. It seems almost impossible to imagine physics without maths, or maths.
I appreciate you saying maths there. Just, I think, for my benefit, for those in England listening.
It's an international competition. At the same time, questions in physics have inspired so many discoveries in math. But does physics simply wear mathematics like a costume? Or is math a fundamental part, the skin, if you will, of physical reality? So really, why does maths seem so unreasonably effective in fundamental physics, especially compared to math's impact in other sciences? How deeply does mathematics shape physics and physics mathematics? And what are the tensions between them, the subtleties, the hidden assumptions, the contradictions and paradoxes at the intersection of formal mathematics and the physics of the real world? We ask you. We ask you, trick or truth.
No, sorry, I just got distracted there imagining mathematics as a skin of physical reality. It sounds a bit creepy. Yeah. But apart from that, what advice can we give to entrants? What have the judges, you know, enjoyed in the past when they've read essays? What has helped entrants score highly?
Well, I always give the same advice. The only thing the winners always have in common is that they make an honest attempt to directly address the question or the topic, and to say something new and meaningful. They're not always the most technical, or the most professional, or the most detailed, or even the best written, but they...
They sound a bit rubbish when you put it like that. They're not. They're really good, I should say.
Yeah. But they are always on topic.
Okay, so what don't the judges like? I guess they don't like it when you kind of go off topic and you just try and talk about what you want to talk about and use the essay contest as an excuse.
That's right. An essay about a different topic. The judges aren't fooled.
You can't fool our judges. They've been well picked. Now, for those that have taken part in the essay contest before, it might be worth noting that there are some rule changes this year, right, Brendan?
That's right. There's two big things. First, our panel for the recent video contest, Show Me the Physics. Really had fun when we gave them a pool of money to award as they saw fit. This year, we'll do the same for the essay contest. We do have a first prize of $10,000 and second and third prizes. But then the panel will have $12,000 to give away however they choose. Who knows? Best new idea, most creative presentation, fewest Wikipedia references. It could be anything. And second, to go along with that flexibility in the prizes, we're going to make the finalist pool a little more fluid. In the past, the finalist pool was determined by voting from entrants and FQXI members, but this year the expert panel can also choose to consider up to 10 additional entries that didn't qualify based on votes.
People reading should still vote. It will push certain essays definitely sort of into contention, right, for the finalist pool.
That's right. This means that technically any entry can in principle win a prize, but only the entries that qualify based on votes are actually guaranteed to be read by the judges.
Please do take a look at the website for more information, www.fqxi.org/community. The closing date for entries is the 4th of March 2015, but essays will start appearing on the site well before that date, and as always, we encourage you to read, rate, and comment on them. Good luck.
The essays are always aimed at a general audience, but if you ever read some of the winning entries and wished they had a bit more technical bite, then you'll be pleased to hear that in January 2015, two compilation volumes with beefed up versions of past winning essays are set to go on sale.
That's right. Essays from our Physics of Information contest, It From Bit or Bit From It, and our No Holds Barred contest, Questioning the Foundations, Which of Our Basic Physical Assumptions is Wrong, have been revised to update them and give them a bit more technical rigor. We'll keep you posted about that on the website and on Twitter at FQXI.
And now we return to the man whose past winning essays appear in both of those volumes, Ian Durham. Drumroll, please, as Ian reveals his top physics story of 2014. And I warn you, this is an intense one, so you may want to settle down and enjoy it with a cup of coffee.
Or a cup of tea.
So, if it's not the Philly Comet landing, what is it?
So number one goes back to some of the things we talked about before. And this is a curious choice for number one. I'll talk about it and then I'll explain a little bit about what it is. So going back to the idea that particles have an intrinsic spin angular momentum to them, that gives rise to magnetism, right? We talked about this in reference to the neutrons and where they were able to isolate the neutron from its magnetic part. Now, there are still some unanswered questions regarding the nature of that magnetism in these things. In particular, it's been known since the 1920s that, you know, fundamental particles, particles that cannot be broken down into parts like a neutron, possess spin angular momentum. So if you actually were to have two electrons near one another, they would interact in a variety of ways. Obviously, they would interact electrostatically. And you even do this in high school, where you're just looking at what's called a Coulomb repulsion. So they would repel each other because they have the same charge. That Coulomb repulsion is pretty strong. So that electrostatic interaction that occurs between these two electrons overshadows the fact that they actually interact if they both have spin, which they do. Electrons have an intrinsic spin. They should, in theory, be interacting magnetically as well. So what these researchers were able to do was they were able to actually measure that magnetic interaction between two electrons, which is just incredible because normally it's just lost in the noise of the electrostatic interaction. So how could they have done this? Well, they did it by entangling the two electrons so that when they're entangled, it reduces the noise, so to speak. So it guarantees this sort of low noise environment, which means that essentially you're kind of subtracting out some of that electrostatic repulsion that would normally occur because the two electrons are now behaving more like a single particle.
I have a clarification question about using entanglement in order to get rid of the kind of electrostatic noise. Why then doesn't it also reduce the magnetic interaction as well?
That's a really good question. I don't know the super detailed answer to that question. What I can say is this. One of the things that you can do, so when you have two electrons, electrostatically, they will always be repulsive, right? Because they have the same charge. In the magnetic case, you can actually make it so that they either repel or attract based on whether their spins are aligned or anti-aligned, meaning are they spinning in the same direction or are they spinning in opposite directions? One of the things, if you look at the plot of the potential of the magnetic interaction and the electrostatic interaction, way down in a certain region, they become pretty close to equal. And so if you reduce the total noise, my guess is that you're getting to a point where you can, reducing the total noise actually gets them more towards where the two interactions have roughly a similar magnitude. And so you could balance them out. So you would have, say, a repulsion due to electrostatic interaction and then an attraction due to the magnetic interaction, and you could get some kind of a balanced state there where they're not actually attractive or repulsive. And so you have this way of getting at that magnetic interaction between the two. And the fact that they were able to measure this is incredible. It solidifies this idea that there is some intrinsic link between spin angular momentum and magnetism. And that's a really deep, deep question. What is that link and why is it there? And I think there are some curious things that need to be explored in that area. And being able to make this measurement directly is just incredible. And so to me, that was my number one.
Let me just ask you about this last sentence about the connection between spin angular momentum and magnetism, because we often just say that they are related. And I guess we don't often think that there's any sort of controversy. Is there some kind of debate? What is it that we don't know here?
There's an argument about whether magnetism is really just electricity viewed through the lens of a moving reference frame. So there's a classical view of magnetism that says it's just a relativistic effect. If you imagine an electron as a little ball, which it's not, but if you imagine it as a little ball spinning around on its axis, and so if this little thing is spinning, which it really isn't, but if it's spinning and it's charged, then you've got charge that's rotating, right? And so there's this assumption that, oh, well, that's why we see magnetism, because this charge itself is moving. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that, because, you know, an electron doesn't have any, theoretically, doesn't actually have a size, which means that, well, what is spinning? Well, there's nothing really spinning. So it's not really like a moving reference frame problem anymore here. So now you have this situation where, what is this relationship between magnetism then? If it's not this relativistic relationship, what's going on here? Why is there a magnetic field at all? Now, in quantum electrodynamics, the relationship is a little bit more complicated. And in fact, even Paul Dirac predicted that magnetic monopoles might exist, although we've never seen them. There are theories that predict, like Dirac's monopole theory and stuff, that you could have magnetism without the presence of electricity. But we've never seen that before. And making a measurement like this sort of hints that maybe we could approach that kind of an idea. This is why you'll see why it went to the top of my list here. If they can do this for electrons, suppose they could do it with neutrinos or some other neutral fundamental particle. Well, now you've got two particles that are interacting magnetically without the presence of any electric charge at all, which is very curious. That's going to be difficult to do.
Okay, so, you know, I'll say that, you know, I didn't know going into this Skype call which you were going to choose as number one, and it's a little bit surprising. This one hasn't had as much fanfare, I guess, over the year, but it's an interesting choice. It's a nice one because you're sort of picking out potential for the future, I guess, from this one.
Yes, and the reason I picked this out is because this has the potential to really open up some additional doors in the realm of fundamental physics and our understanding of how fundamental physics works. And it's a long-standing problem that often gets overlooked. One of the things that we get lost in is we've made so much progress in science in the last century or more. We forget that there are some very fundamental basic problems that or questions that have never been answered, at least satisfactorily. And I think some of these very basic questions about spin and electromagnetism are really, really important and very, you know, fundamental to understanding quantum mechanics and quantum systems. Because another one was there's a thing on the concept of tetraquarks.
I was going to ask you about the tetraquark thing. And it's because the Large Hadron Collider confirmed something that people had sort of seen before. And that's this idea that maybe you could have a particle that has four quarks rather than three as we might expect. And then there's some controversy. Is it a particle? Is it a molecule made up of, you know, particles with two quarks? There's some question here and some excitement about understanding what quarks are or whether they're even things at all. And, you know, there's something more fundamental that we should be thinking about.
Right. And the only reason the tetraquark thing, which is basically quark states that have more than three quarks, why this didn't make the list? Well, they were technically first observed in 2007, so it didn't really make the list for that reason.
So this was on a couple of lists, but actually I was going to bring it up and ask you, you know, if it had made your list, pretty much exactly the same question that I asked you when we were talking about BICEP 2, which was, you know, why is it if, you know, the experiment was done earlier, hints were found earlier in other experiments, but now there's a whole load of talk about it because it's been confirmed at the LHC. You know, at what point does something become exciting? Who gets the credit?
That's a good question. I think in regards to the tetraquark question, I think the answer is clearer, at least in my mind. In 2007, a Japanese group detected the tetraquark to a level of 6 sigma. To me, if we had been doing this in 2007, that would have been on my list, because that right there is pretty impressive in and of itself. Yes, the Large Hadron Collider confirmed that measurement and to a greater accuracy, But I think in this case, I think the initial discovery was a bigger deal. But that is a pretty amazing discovery. I remember there was a controversy over the pentaquark, where they had supposedly discovered states of five quarks, but then that turned out to not be the case. This has confirmation, where they had the tetraquark discovered in 2007, and now, 7 years later, they've confirmed that there are tetraquark places. And that's really amazing new physics, too, because it will force us to hone in on the correct theory.
So there we have it, our top five, overturning physics at the top. So quite impressive there.
I am in keeping with my penchant for being a little controversial here. It's not really a sexy number one either, but I just think from a fundamental standpoint, it's the biggest story that is being overlooked a little bit. This is an experiment, was they were able to actually measure that magnetic interaction between two electrons. Like I said, if we could do this with non-charged fundamental particles, which again would be a tall order, you know, if we could do that, though, then that's really new physics. I mean, really new physics. That will settle some debates in quantum field theory. So it's not as sexy, but it's more interesting to a fundamental physics person.
Right.
And so there we have this year's number one. It's not sexy, but it's more interesting to a fundamental physics person, which I think we should make FQXI's new slogan.
I'm not sure how I feel about that one, Brendan.
Well, we could talk about it later. But it is an excellent, well-argued choice from Ian at number one. So congratulations to Shlomi Kotler, Nitzan Ackerman, Nir Navin, Yinan Glickman, and Rui Ozeri of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel for being the first group to measure the extremely weak magnetic interaction between two single electrons.
Details of that achievement are on the website, along with all the others listed in Ian's list at www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, along with news articles about the LHC's tetraquark discovery, which Ian also mentioned there. That just leaves us time to thank Ian Durham once more and to wish you all the best for the holiday season.
And from all of us at FQXI, we hope you have a happy new year.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali. FQXI. It's not sexy, but it's fundamental.
No, Brendan. Just no.
FQXI. It's sexy and it's fundamental.
Yeah, that's better. I like that one.